Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Pamela Rose. She was a Bletchley girl, one of the women who spent the war years working in total secrecy, painstakingly indexing snippets of information that would prove vital to beating the Nazis. A clandestine role that's recently made its way from the historical shadows of Britain's wartime past to the megawatt glare of the silver screen in movies like Enigma and The Imitation Game. But my guest today has no truck with the glamorising of her wartime work. The truth is, she says, it was often boring and something of a disappointment to a young woman who herself had early ambitions to be an actress. A half-hearted debutante, she abandoned the season to spend time in Paris and Munich, going on to drama school in London later. Yet she gave up dreams of her name in lights on Shaftesbury Avenue for the indexing section of Hut 4, turning down her first chance to appear in the West End and opting instead for the undercover job at Bletchley. She would finally achieve her dream nearly 60 years later, making her West End acting debut at the age of 83. She says, "I think when you're as old as I am, you feel as if you're walking alongside yourself, watching yourself with great interest, wondering what you're going to do next." And so, Pamela Rose, at 97 now, I wonder what's on your to-do list.
Desert Island Discs, I think.
Good. I'm glad you've made the time. Many of us have seen the movies Enigma and The Imitation Game,
yes.
Those films about Bletchley
yes.
Park. How realistic a picture do they paint?
I haven't seen them because I'm very blind and I can't see in the cinema very well. And I'm waiting for the DVD to come out and I shall watch it on that. And I will say, all my friends who weren't at Bletchley think that The Imitation Game is wonderful. And all my friends who were think it's rubbish. And I suppose it's a mixture of the two.
We are going to talk, I hope, in some detail later about how you ended up at Bletchley Park and about the type of work you did there. None of it was public knowledge, I think, until the 1970s. What was it like when suddenly the truth came to light?
Well, you know, my memory of the 1970s is that people weren't all that interested. They seemed to be much more interested now. Bletchley seemed quite a long way away. The fact that we'd broken the codes was wonderful, and this perhaps saved lives was wonderful, but it was part of history, and we were all getting on with our lives and doing other things.
That notion of it being part of history then, what did the war effort mean to you there and then, as a young woman?
Well, I suppose underneath, most of us felt that we really were fighting for our survival and for the survival of the things that we believed in. But I think everybody seemed so friendly. I suppose it's like a match, really. I've never been a great sports watcher, but we were a team. The whole country was a team.
Pamela, let me ask you then, for your first disc of the morning, what are we going to hear and why have you chosen this?
Well, my first disc is a duet from Mozart's Don Giovanni and goes right back to my parents. My father was an opera singer before the war, and my mother had aspirations to be one. My parents used to have once a month what they called a PWE, a pleasant Wednesday evening, and they would ask about 50 friends who would sit on little gold chairs, and they'd have food either before or afterwards, and then they would perform, and many of their musical friends would perform too, and they'd have little concerts once a month. And the thing I remember my parents singing more than anything is this duet from Don Giovanni. And I love to hear them singing it.
And
La Ci Darem La Mano from Act One of Mozart's Don Giovanni, sung there by Barbara Bonney and Håkan Harkakort, played by the Drottingham Court Theatre Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Arnold Oestman. And you chose that, Pamela Rose, because you said it was often sung by your parents during what they named their PWEs, their pleasant Wednesday evenings. Oh, that we should all have PWEs in our life. You were born then in 1917. Your parents were Dolly and Thornley. The First World War had been going on for 3 years when your father had been at the front, but he was injured.
Yes, my mother had a direct line to God. She always made that quite clear, and she was very specific in the things she asked for. And she asked for my father to be wounded in the left leg, because she said if he was wounded in the left leg, he would get what they call a blighty and would come home, and otherwise he'd be killed. And sure enough, he was wounded in the left leg.
You were sent to boarding school at the age of 8. Tell me about that.
My brother had gone to boarding school, and I was left with a nanny, whom I loved dearly. I was sent off to a little sort of dame school at Broadstairs.
And you liked it?
I loved it, yes, because I had two things which I loved. One was elocution lessons with an elderly, retired actress. But we did have a splendid time together doing Victorian ballads. And I also was allowed to ride there. And we had a wonderful riding master who had been some sort of a cowboy. And instead of having very posh riding lessons, which we had at my next school, we were allowed to sort of try and stand up in the saddle and crack a whip and all sorts of things and go over jumps standing up and do really quite exciting things in a small field behind the school.
Much more fun. When you had those early elocution lessons with the retired actress, did that immediately strike a chord with you? I mean, you clearly still have a very beautiful, sort of quite sonorous voice, really.
I wanted to be an actress, and that's why they arranged for the lessons for me.
You already did at that age, did you?
Yes, I wanted to be an actress from the start, from when I first remember it. We did quite a lot of acting at home. We quite often played charades.
It's time for some more of your discs, Pamela Rose, your second of the day. Tell me what we're going to hear now.
We're going to hear Yvette Guilbert now. And I don't suppose many people listening have even heard of Yvette Guilbert. But she was a sort of forerunner of Edith Piaf. And when I was sent to France to learn French after school, the mother of the family that I went to felt very strongly for me that I wanted to go on the stage. She signed me up with this lady who was giving a course of cabaret lessons, really, and she was one of the first singers at the Moulin Rouge. She's rumoured to be the mistress of Edward VII, perhaps I should say a mistress of Edward VII, and she also taught me French. She was extremely nice to me, and she had these wonderful songs. I've chosen The Voyage to Bethlehem because I also find it very touching, and it makes me think of her more than all the others. Il est minuit. Il est né de divin enfant, sonné au bois, résonné musette. Il est né de divin enfant, sonné au bois, résonné souvent. Depuis plus de 4000 ans, elle avait annoncé les prophètes. Il est né le petit enfant. Jouer au bois résonnait souvent. Il est né le divin enfant.
The Voyage to Bethlehem, sung there by Yvette Guilbert, one-time star of the Moulin Rouge and also your French teacher in the time that you spent in Paris. That was recorded in 1933. So this time that you spent in Paris, Pamela Rose, it was either that or learning to type here in London, was it?
Well, but that's it, really. I mean, also, my parents did want me to learn languages. I already had done quite well in French at school.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, I speak French and German quite adequately well, and a bit of Italian, and a very little bit of Spanish at all. I think I went to France in 35 and Munich in 36.
Now, this is at a time then. If you were in Munich in 36, when it was, I mean, it was the capital of the movement, the Nazi movement at that time.
And it's most extraordinary. My mother had an aunt by marriage, and they took a few boys, and they didn't want to take me because I was a girl, and she said it would be too much responsibility. So I went to a friend of hers opposite called the Griff in Malotti. And I stayed there for 3 months and learnt, I suppose, quite good German. I was very well aware of Hitler, but not of quite how awful he was.
Can I just try to have you describe a little the atmosphere in Munich at that time?
Well, it's rather difficult. If I'd been living with a proper German family who didn't take other students, I should have seen more of it. But these were people who expressly took English and I suppose American students. And I think the atmosphere was really, I wasn't sensitive enough to realise what a lot must have been going down underneath. I didn't much like the idea of the Hitlerjugend. It didn't seem to me terribly warlike, because I had no idea what warlike was. And I didn't read the newspapers much. And, I mean, one is very, very self-centred, I think, at that age very often. I wanted to get back more than anything and get onto the stage. I can remember even when I was rehearsing, the very first professional play I was in was at the time of Munich. And I wasn't praying, you know, let there be no war for any other reason except that I wanted to open and play the part, which I got, was rather a nice one. And I'm sorry to say, I'm deeply ashamed now, but I'm sorry to say, I don't think I was very rarely political at all or aware of the ghastly things that were going on all around. I was just like, I suppose, many young people, living my own life.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad you said that, because I think that is to be young,
it's to be young, yes.
Preoccupied with yourself.
Yes.
Let's have some more of your discs, Pamela Rose. Tell me about this next thing that we're going to hear now. Not a piece of music, in fact. Just tell us why you've chosen this.
Oh, well, the best part, I think, I had all the time I was on the stage, both before and after my marriage. It was the Playboy of the Western World. And that wonderful actor, Cyril Cusack, was going to play the Playboy. And I put in for the part of Peggy Mike and got it. And so I played opposite Cyril. And although we were never recorded, I would love to hear Cyril's voice saying some of those marvellous speeches, because it is one of the really important moments of my life as far as the theatre was concerned.
Oh, let you wait to hear me talking till we're astray in Erris when Good Friday's by, drinking a sup from a well and making mighty kisses with our wetted mouths, or gaming in a gap of sunshine with yourself stretched back onto your necklace in the flowers of the earth.
I'd be nice, so is it?
Oh, if the mitred bishop seen you that time, they'd be the like of the holy prophets, I'm thinking, to be straying in the bars of paradise to lay eyes on the Lady Helena Try, and she abroad, pacing back and forward with a nosegay in her golden shawl.
And what is it I have, Christie Mahon, to make me fit an entertainment for the like of you, that has such poets talking, and such bravery of heart?
Isn't there the light of seven heavens in your heart alone? The way you'll be an angel's lamp to me from this out, and I abroad in the darkness, spearing salmons in the Owen or the Carrow Moor.
If I was your wife, I'd be along with you those nights.
That was an extract from Act 3 of the John Millington Synge play The Playboy of the Western World, performed there by Cyril Cusack and Siobhan McKenna. So you went on to study drama then, a very happy moment for you, Pamela Rose, yes, at the Webber Douglas School. And then in the early 40s, you were in something called ENSA, which was the Entertaining the Troops.
We all had to do that. You could stay on the stage, you had to be in work. And everybody had to do so much ENSA.
And at one point you were in Birmingham, and that was during the Blitz. What do you remember of that?
Oh, I remember the Blitz very clearly. Just lots of bangs and red things and burning and smoke.
Were you afraid?
Funnily enough, no. It seemed so exciting. I mean, when something was very near and everything shook, I thought, ooh, that was near. Perhaps we were all acting to one another. Perhaps we were very deep down. I should have been afraid if I'd been alone, but I never was. I was always a group of actors.
And did the show go on every night, or did you suspend performances?
I don't think we ever suspended a performance, no.
And then there came a moment, I believe, when it was your godmother, I think, that suggested that there was a place that needs girls like you. What did she mean, and how did she know about Bletchley?
Well, one of her sons was connected with it. I suppose, to be honest, she meant girls like you, girls about whose families we know something. We know now, after all those spy scandals and things, that good family doesn't mean you're going to be loyal to your country necessarily. But the idea was at that time that if they picked, because they had to pick a great many girls, if they could find girls of good family who had adequate languages to cope with the signals, they would be very useful at Bletchley. And I suppose we were.
And there weren't that many people speaking German in Britain to the standard that you could at that time.
That's probably true, but I expect all over there were. But they had to also, they thought, know about us and about our provenance. I mean, they may have been wrong, but on the whole, I think nobody ever did find out about Bletchley, because surely they'd have bombed us otherwise.
You sent off your application then, and at the same time, another letter, an important letter, arrived from your agent. Tell me about that.
I was offered an understudy and a small part in a play called Watch on the Rhine,
yes.
A very popular play in the West End, and would have been a very good thing. So when I had my interview, I was interviewed by a don called Frank Birch, who was head of Naval Section Intelligence, and I knew he knew about the theatre. He was very keen on it. So I said to him at the end of the interview, he said, well, we'd like you. And I said, well, now I've got a real problem, because I've just been offered my first West End part, and I'd quite like to do that too. What would you do? And he said to me, well, the stage can wait and the war can't. So I went to Bletchley.
Tell me about your next piece then, Pamela Rose. What are we going to hear now? This is your fourth.
We're going to hear Night and Day, because Night and Day by Cole Porter is, to me, sort of resonant with all my youth. Before the war, dancing, just being young. And they were still playing it a year or two later when I met my husband at Bletchley. So I should like that.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day.
Cole Porter's Night and Day, sung there by Fred Astaire. I should tell listeners, Pamela Rose, that throughout that you had the most beatific smile on your face. You were right back in the moment. Does it seem like only a moment ago?
Sometimes it seems like only a moment ago, and sometimes it seems like ages ago. So long. My life seems to me to have been very long, I must say.
Well, 97, it is quite long.
It is quite long.
A young girl then, with this obviously a sense of drama and creative notions. You know, a life on the stage was what you were interested in. You were given the job at Bletchley, and they would have asked you to sign the Official Secrets
yes.
Act. And I'm wondering, given that, you know, you liked drama and you had
yes.
an imagination, what were your expectations of your job?
I fully expected that I might be dropped over France or something. It's a very glorified idea of my languages, because they weren't nearly good enough for that. But I thought it might be going to be very exciting, and I must say it wasn't when I first got there.
Tell me about the pervading atmosphere in the indexing section of Hut 4.
We had a lot of fun, but we were very serious too. I went there as a so-called linguist, and I was moved to temporary senior administrative officer.
So you were promoted?
I did go to meetings and things like that with other heads of section, but I had also to arrange for people like the Baroness Trumpington, for instance, who were one of my younger girls, not to keep going on leave when they wanted to, so that they could see their boyfriends.
Yes, she was Jean Campbell-Harris, just
That's
plain
right,
Jean
Campbell-Harris. Campbell-Harris.
And of course, you say Baroness Trumpington, she of the infamous two-fingered salute in the House of Lords.
That's right,
yes.
Absolutely.
She said
she
of
was
her...
just as naughty then as
yes.
she is now.
Oh, good, I'm glad you brought that out, because she has said of her days at Bletchley, I often behaved very badly indeed. What did she get up to?
One night, I remember, we put her in a laundry basket and gave her a push. And she careered off down a passage and ended up in a naval commander's office.
Ah.
And he wasn't terribly pleased, I must say.
And did you behave badly? I mean, were you sort of dashing off to see boyfriends?
Well, I was dashing off to see boyfriends too, yes, until the glorious day when I met Jim Rose. Then he was a Bletchley too. And so we had our fun where we were, really.
This day-to-day role, then, of actually, you know, yes. We mentioned earlier the index cards and the linguist skills. What were you actually doing?
What happened was that the codes were broken, and then they were sent to something called a Z-room. This happened in the naval section, in the air section, and in the army section, but all separately. The codes were broken. They were rather like text messages, really, and they were sent to a room where they were put into proper German. Then they came to us, and we had to, because there were no computers, of course, we had to make a note of everything in importance in the signal and index it so that people working on intelligence could come and get all the, say, it's a ship like the Scharnhorst, it would have an index card. Then every move it made that was mentioned in signals would be on that card and cross-referenced with the ports it was at and any other information we had about it, really. So it was a very large index.
And what of the famed cryptanalyst Alan Turing et al., his highfalutin team? Did you ever meet Alan Turing?
I met him once at breakfast because he was having breakfast with Jim. I mean, he just seemed like a perfectly nice, ordinary person.
And there were no rumours of what these very big-brained people were working on at the time?
I think to say that we none of us had any idea of what we were doing it is not true. We did have.
Tell us, Pamela Rose, about your next piece of music. This is your fifth disc of the morning.
First of all, I love Kathleen Ferrier's voice. And secondly, Benjamin Britten, who was quite young then, also loved her voice and wrote this opera for her. And Jim and I, we were married in 1946, and we went to it that summer. And it was the first thing we went to together. And it was wonderfully exciting. We had a walking tour on the Downs first with our evening dress in rucksacks and then took a taxi to Glyndebourne. It was very grand. And it was very exciting to be there.
Oh, if it were all a dream, then waiting would be less a nightmare. Then you slept well.
Hush She Comes from Benjamin Britten's Rape of Lucretia, sung by Kathleen Ferrier with Anna Polak and Margaret Ritchie, accompanied by the English Opera Group Orchestra conducted by Reginald Goodall, and that was recorded in 1946. And you specifically chose that, Pamela Rose, because of the memories you have of you and your new husband walking across the Sussex Downs with your evening dress in your backpack before you headed to Glyndebourne. The fiercely good-looking wing commander, Jim Rose, then, when did you... You met him at Bletchley.
I met him at Bletchley.
Yes. Can you remember the first time you met?
Yes, I can. It was at a dance, and funnily enough, Jean Campbell-Harris comes into it again, because we had continual hops in what I think you would call... to a gramophone, in a sort of drill hall, where everything took place. There was one I didn't really want to go to, and Jean said, "Oh, do come, I don't want to go alone." So I said, "All right." And Jim asked me to dance. And I'd seen Jim from afar in the canteen and places like that and thought he looked rather attractive. But he had a great reputation for taking care of sort of wallflowers and people he was sorry for. So immediately he asked me to dance. I thought, oh, I wonder what's wrong with me. But in fact, apparently not much.
There was one small but significant fly in the ointment because he, like a lot of people, had rushed into a marriage in 1939, I think. So he was in the middle of a divorce when you met him.
Yes, he was in the middle of a divorce.
And getting divorced in those days was a damn sight trickier than it is now.
It was terrible because if you were a gentleman, you had to take the blame. And Jim had to go down to Brighton with a lady whom he paid and they apparently played cards all night. And then when the chambermaid came with the breakfast in the morning, she had been, I suppose, paid a fiver or something, and she was then the witness. She'd seen you in bed when she brought the breakfast. But you had to have definite testimony that you were in bed with somebody else.
As proof of adultery.
Absolutely, yes.
Let's have some more music, Pamela Rose.
We went to Zurich after the war. They were looking for somebody to start up an international press institute. And the idea was to make countries love one another by their editors meeting and getting to understand one another. And, in fact, we were in Zurich for 10 years. And my one joy while we were in Zurich, really, apart from the fact we had two children, they were great fun and they liked Zurich. I was a little bit bored, I have to say, but my great friend there was really a friend of my father's called Edwin Fisher, who was a wonderful pianist and musician. And one day he came to see us and he was going to play this Beethoven sonata. He was playing a concert that night. And he said, it's really dedicated to the Gräfin Braun. I'm going to dedicate it to Pamela. So always afterwards, it's been my sonata, and I love it very much.
That was part of Beethoven's Sonata No. 10 in G major, played by another friend of yours, Dennis Matthews, there, Pamela Rose. When you did come back to London, as you say, you'd been in Zurich and your husband had worked before that as literary editor of The Observer, and then he had set up and co-founded, indeed, in 1968, the Runnymede Trust.
Yes.
Throughout all of this, did you have a sense of, aside from having your children and being a mother, of feeling slightly sort of champing at the bit, that there was something else?
In Zurich, yes.
Yes.
In Zurich, because Zurich was also, in those days, very old-fashioned and very sort of, for instance, when we brought our furniture over, although my husband was extremely busy, he had to go down to the border and sign for them because a woman couldn't sign for them. And a lot of the cantons hadn't got the vote in those days.
Indeed.
So it was really like being in a 19th-century play, almost.
Well, talking of plays, were you not indeed yourself tempted just to get back into the theatre? And
well, I'd promised no, because I promised Jim I wouldn't. When he said, shall we get married? He said, you know, I don't think it would work if you went back to the stage. Remember, these were quite old-fashioned days, because he said you'd always be going out when I'm coming in. And, of course, it's true. And I've got a great many friends who did stay on the stage, and most of them didn't stay with the same person all that long. And so I suppose, since I never wanted to be with anyone else, really, once I'd met him, I did the right thing. I did go back to stage after he died.
He died in 1999 then.
Yes.
And yes, you went back, as I said in the introduction earlier this morning, you went onto the West End stage and you were aged 83.
83, that's right, yes.
First of all, how did it come about that you were
offered the part? Well, I had an old friend called Sam Beasley, and when Jim died, he said to me after a month or two, you know, you can't sit on your bottom for the rest of your life. You'd better come back to the Actors' Centre and do some classes and get back on the stage, which he had done. So I went to the Actors' Centre, and they very kindly took me, and I did some classes, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and got myself an agent. And she suddenly rang up one day, just before Christmas, I remember, and said, I think I've got a job for you. Go down to the Haymarket, and they're putting on Lady Windermere's Fan. And was given the part of Lady Jedburgh, and also understudied Googie Withers. And it was quite a distinguished production. It had Vanessa Redgrave, Jack Davenport. It was quite alarming, but of course if there's one thing that doesn't drive out but subdues grief, it's fear. And I was pretty afraid, really, to start with. But I had a lovely time.
How did you find, at the age of 83, not just learning your own part, but understudying one of the main parts? I mean, was it easy for you to learn the lines?
Well, I really did study very hard. I mean, all over Christmas, I was learning not my part, but Googie's part. Luckily, because on the third night, suddenly I heard her say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm ill, I can't go on." And she walked off. And the stage manager looked down at me, rather superciliously, I thought, and said, "Can you go on?" So I said, "Yes." And on I went.
Did it have cause to make you think, being back on the stage after 60 years, and given that you'd fallen in love with Jim and had a very, very happy marriage for all those years, gosh, what I gave up?
No, not really. I'm not a regretter, really, much. You can't have everything. And I think I've had more than my share, really.
It's time for your seventh piece of music, then, Pamela. Tell me what we're going to hear now.
We're going to hear Summertime from Porgy and Bess by Gershwin. To me, it springs like a flower out of darkness, and that's what I love about it.
Summertime from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, sung by Cynthia Heyman. The music was played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra with the Glyndebourne Chorus, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. You said earlier to me, Pamela Rose, you can't have everything and I've had more than most. I wonder, given your experiences, given all the decades that you've lived, what do you think the ingredients are for living a long and fulfilled life?
Well, luck's the greatest, I suppose. I think I've got an optimistic temperament. And I'm lucky in that. I inherited that from my parents, I think. And a good partner's the greatest thing of all. Family is a wonderful thing. A belief of some sort is great. I don't mean necessarily belonging to a strict religion. But I think believing in the human spirit, in the fact there is something there that's worth preserving and being.
Because it's Desert Island Discs, I've been asking you to look back at your life and to tell me about all those decades and years ago and your time at Bletchley. I'm wondering, though, if you spend much time talking to your own children and grandchildren about the war.
About the war?
Yes.
When they ask, yes. I'm much more interested in what they're doing, really. I had a taxi driver the other day who was teaching his daughters about the war. And when I told him that I'd been at Bletchley in the war, he said, "Can I take your photograph?" He was so thrilled to find somebody who'd been at Bletchley.
Now, you know, given that this is Desert Island Discs, I'm cruelly going to cast you away. I'm wondering if there's anything about life on your own on this desert island that you'll actually look forward to.
Not really, no. I don't mind being alone. I like people very much. I think if I can have my eyes back, which I'm sure I can, I shall enjoy reading.
So tell me then about your final piece.
I've chosen the Schubert Piano Sonata in B minor because it was the thing that was in Jim's CD player when he came back from hospital. He took a little CD player with him. And also we had it played by a friend at his memorial service. And it would remind me, first of all, of Jim. It's a little slow and it's a little sad. But I think I'd feel rather nostalgic on that island. And I'd like to have him with me.
That was part of the second movement of Schubert's Piano Sonata in B-flat Major, played by Alfred Brendel. So, Pamela Rose, I'm going to give you the books now. As you mentioned, you will take to this island the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible and another book, too, of your own. What are you going to take?
I'd like the complete works, or if not the complete works, the complete poetry of T.S. Eliot. First of all, cats would make me laugh. And Ash Wednesday has my motto in it for old age. And now I rejoice at having to construct something upon which to rejoice.
Well, we shall give you the collected poems of T.S. Eliot then. And what luxury would make your life just a little bit more bearable?
A very, very, very comfortable four-poster bed with a Macintosh roof.
Yes.
Would that be allowed?
Definitely. I'll construct it myself.
Thank you.
Yes, it certainly would be allowed. And finally, if you had to save one of these eight discs that you've chosen, which one would you save from the waves?
I think Summertime, because such a pure, joyful note, really.
It's yours. Pamela Rose, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
It has been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.